We're beginning now with Masechet Baba Metzia. We'll give a short introduction to Baba Metzia since, as the Gemara noted in a number of places, we're going to see again today, that Seder Nezikim Echad Hu, that really Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Baba Batra are really parts of a larger Masechet called Masechet Nezikim that was broken down into three parts, Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, and Baba Batra. And so much of what we spoke about going into Baba Kama is also applicable to Baba Metzia. Now, with regards to Baba Kama really focused on issues of Nezek and issues of torts. And Baba Kama really plumbed the depths of those issues, as well as issues like Gezel and Ganav. So in those cases, we're talking about interactions between parties, but in a case where there's one party that is a victim and the other party that is the problematic party. And therefore, there is a claim against that party. In Baba Metzia focuses more on transactions or interactions between parties. And so that is that they have some sort of relationship, whether that's because they engaged in a transaction, they have a relationship because they are depositing something with someone else, or because of they lent money to someone else. Those interactions are what the Gemara in Baba Metzia deals with. Now, as opposed to Baba Batra, Baba Metzia deals with those issues that are mentioned in the Torah. These are, I'll call them civil laws, but civil laws that are not just given to anyone to decide to create a social contract or agreement between parties, but rather civil laws that are governed by the Torah. And therefore, we're going to find things, what we're going to start with today is Hashavat Aveda, Aveda and the rules that surround an Aveda. We're talking about Rebit, the charging of interest. We're going to talk about Prika Tiina, loading animals, unloading animals, Ona'a, overcharging or undercharging people in transactions. Those types of topics are what are found in Baba Metzia because these are civil laws governed by the Torah. Later on, we'll deal with the Shomrim, the different relationships or situations that can be created between parties. And then at the end of the Masechta, it will slide over to discuss what's called a Bayit Valiyah, when people are shared owners of a property, what are the rights or obligations of those parties. That really moves us towards Baba Batra. Baba Batra is also about the relationships between parties or neighbors, but those relationships or issues are the laws that were instituted by the Chachamim, not necessarily the Torah laws. Over here in Baba Metzia, we're dealing with the Torah-prescribed civil laws. Baba Batra is really the structure of laws or civil body of laws that the Torah Shebaal Peh creates in order to make it that we have individuals who can live next to each other, people can interact with each other and have a basis for dealing with each other. Later on in Baba Batra, it deals with Yerusha, which is, again, De'oraita. But that might be the main difference between that of Baba Metzia and Baba Batra is the focus on what is the source of the laws or what are the derivation of the laws. Now, there are light motifs throughout Baba Metzia. One of the light motifs in Baba Metzia is what we call, according to the Ramban, Vasita HaYashar VaTov. That's an overarching theme that the Ramban, similar to his view with regards to Kedoshim to you, he says a similar thing with Asita Yashar Vatov, which is that is the mandate of the Torah for people to act justly and righteously and do good. That's the way that you're supposed to interact. That should govern your interactions with other people. The Torah lays out laws that tell us what to do or prescribe what to do in certain situations, but the overarching theme is Vasita Yashar Vatov. And therefore, when you have a doubt, or if you look at the laws on an individual basis, they should amalgamate to create a situation where you're doing Vasita Yashar Vatov. That's definitely a theme or underlining motif of that which takes place in Baba Metzia, which is that there is a spirit of the law. There's a Lefnim Yishurat HaDin, not just the letter of the law. And there's an objective to these laws, and there's an objective to that which is mentioned here. That does also parlay itself into Baba Batra, which is once you have that overarching thing, Vasita Yashar Vatov, and the Torah prescribes different parts of that, which help us to piece it together and make the puzzle. Once you have that, then you understand in Baba Batra why you have to have certain laws or why you institute certain laws, because you want to continue or extrapolate that theme of Asita V'Yashar V'Tov. The second leitmotif that is throughout the Masechta is the issue of Kinyan, which is the issue of acquisition, change of ownership, or how people, when they interact, how do we have a passing of control from one party to the other? Underlying all the different laws that we speak about here is the necessity to understand who is in control and when does that control shift. And that always revolves around the issue of kinyan. When does a person have an acquisition or when does a person own an object? So kinyanim also play a role. They aren't spoken about in an abstract form like we saw in Kiddushin, where Kiddushin tells about the different types of kinyanim that you can make and how they function or where they function. In Bava Metzia, it's always in the context of whatever they're discussing. But whatever we're discussing, for instance, an aveda, and a lost item, when does the person who finds the aveda, when does it become his? When does it become his fully? When does he have responsibilities to the other parties? All of those revolve around kinyanim and the movement of property from one party to the other, and that's true of almost all the sugyot that we deal with within Bava Metzia. Now, given that little introduction, the Balei HaTosafot still note that there is an obligation for us to understand why Bava Metzia is found here, or why is this the next perek that follows that of Bava Kama. So he said, of course, according to the one who says that Kula Masechta Achadi, it's all one big Masechta, you have to explain why the case is that we just finished with the Gozel Batra, and now we're starting with Shnayim Mochzim. But even according to the one he says that does not think it was one big Masechta, and we differentiate between the different parts of the Masechta, for instance, with regards to the halacha of Stam, V'achakach Machloket, or Machloket V'achakach Stam, where they're determining whether Mishnayot are really in order, that individual believes that these Masechtot are totally separate. They're not considered to be one big Masechta, and therefore you can make a decision about the order of the Mishnayot. So he says, even if you believe that, that's only with regards to this halacha, Tosafot says, that we don't know in which way Rabbi taught the students the material. But then in the end, when Rabbi put the Masechto together and put the Storim together, there has to be a logic, there has to be a reason why he put one parak after another or why he put one Masechta after another. And therefore, Tosafot says that obligates us to understand what's Shnayim Mochzim doing over here. In many senses, the first parak should have been Ela Metziot. Shnayim Mochzim is talking about an Aveda. It's talking about people's interaction with an Aveda. If that's the case, why don't you start with the basic laws of Aveda, which would be Ela Metziot? So in a sense, the next parak would have been much more apt to be the first parak here rather than Shnayim Mochzim. The Tosfot says the reason that we start with Shnayim Mochzim is because of the fact that yesterday's daf, when we left off on Bava Kama, the last Mishnah there and the last daf really discussed when two parties are interacting over some sort of agreement or work between them, the items, the residual that comes away from that, who does that belong to? Does that belong to the owner or does that belong to the craftsman? But you have two vying parties for that which is there. And so the last stop or the end of Gozel Batra deals with exactly that issue, where two parties have a claim on something. Who is the rightful claimant or the rightful owner of that item? Shnayim Mochzim just continues that thematically. We have two people grabbing onto something. How do we adjudicate between them? How do we decide who is the party that it belongs to? So there, Tosfot says that this Shnayim Mochzim is the continuation, in a sense, thematically of a Gozel Batra, and that's why it's found as the first parak in Bava Metzia. Right? With that, we begin the first Mishnah in Bava Metzia. Shnayim Ochzim B'Talit. You have two individuals who are holding on to a garment, a talit. Talit here means clothing or a cloak. It doesn't mean a talit like we think of today, which is the religious article called a talit. In their day, a talit meant a tunic, a cloak, some sort of clothing. It'll become more apparent in the Gemara why it's important that it is a talit. But you just, before we get there, can understand why a talit is interesting. First of all, it's something that people can hold or grab onto. Number two, it's something that more than one person can be holding onto. And the last thing is, it's something that possibly could be divided between the parties. So for all those reasons, talit is the example that is used in the Mishnah, but it's not necessarily exclusive to a talit. You have to look at the characteristics or the nature of the halacha here and see if it applies to other items. But talit is used, and we'll see in the Gemara, we'll discuss why. Zeomer ani mitzatia. This individual says, I found it. Zeomer ani mitzatia. The other guy says, I found it. So we're dealing with an aveda, a lost object. And two parties are the claimants here as to the ones that found it. Zeomer kulashali. This one says it's all mine. Zeomer kulashali. And the other one says it's all mine. Zei shavash ein lo pachot michetzia. This one will take a shvua that he has no less than 50% of the item. And the other party will also take a shvuah that he owns no less than 50% of it. Again, the Gemara will discuss why this is the formulation of this shvuah, because of the nature of their claims as well as what we want from them. So the Gemara will speak about the exact language. But basically, we want them both to corroborate their claim with a shvuah. We want them to back up the claim with a shvuah. If they both take a shvuah, biachloku, then they will split it. So that is the outcome of the situation is, if they both make a full claim for the item, they both take a shvuah to that effect, we're dealing with an aveda, then we will split it between them. We'll come back and discuss this in a minute. Zeomer kula shaliv, zeomer chetziah shali. This one says, it totally belongs to me. The other one says, only half of it belongs to me. Omer kula shali, ishava, she'en lo ba, pachot mishlosha chalakim. The one who says it's all mine should take a shvuah that he has no less than 75% of this object. Shlosha chalakim means 3 out of 4 parts over here. He takes a shvuah that he has at minimum 75% of this item. Ve'omer chetziah shali, the one who says that half of it belongs to me, ishava, she'en lo pachot mirivyah. He should take a shvuah to the fact that he has no less than 25% of this object. Zenotel shlosha chalakim, the one who says it's totally his, takes 3/4 of the item. Zenotel revia, and the other one takes 25%. Now, this type of division, even though it seems like it's simple, is one of many ways that you could have chosen to make the division between the parties. Just as an example, you could have said that they should split it 1/3, 2/3. In terms of their claims here, the party says Zekula Shali, making a claim on the first 50% and the second 50%. The one who says, I'm making a claim on half of it, he's only making one claim for 50%. It means that there are 3 claims here. Then you would give 1/3 of it to one claimant, 2/3 to the other claimant. The fact that we divide it up by 3/4 and 1/4 follows a logical way to divide items. We've discussed this before. According to Professor Oman, the Mishnah and Ketubot and this Mishnah are parallel in their logic of division. The Mishnah Ketubot that says a woman has a ketubah worth 100, another woman has 200, and one has 300. How do you divide up the estate or the monies of the husband between them? So the same logic that is used here is used over there, according to him. And the logic is, whenever parties agree about the item, it's taken out of the picture. So here, when the first guy says, it's all mine, he doesn't admit to anything. The second guy comes along and says, only 50% of it is mine. That means on the admission, meaning the second 50%, he's not even going to adjudicate. He agrees it's the other parties. So what we do is we say that 50% is given to the one who made the full claim. Now, their argument is only over the remaining 50%. That 50% we're going to divide evenly, yachloku, so each one will get 25%. That means in total, the one who said kulashli ends up with 75%, and the one who says that it's partly mine, it gets 25%. Again, that's a method, it's a logical method for division. But you have to know that it's not just a given that you would divide it that way. As we mentioned before, there are other ways to divide it. There are other logics that could dictate how you deal with such a situation. But this is the way or the method that the Mishnah uses for dividing up the property when they have these types of claims against each other. Hayu shnayim rochvim agabe beima. Two individuals were riding on an animal. Oshay achad rochev achad manig. One of them was riding, one of them was leading the animal. Zeomer kula shali, zeomer kula shali. Each one of them makes a claim that the entire animal is theirs. Zei shavah she'en lo pachot mechetziah. That one will take a shvuah that he has no less than 50% of the item. Zei shavah she'en lo pachot mechetziah. He will also take a shvuah to the effect that he has no less than 50% here. Ve'yach loku. And they will divide it up. This is not very different than the ratio we have to discuss in the Gemara, why the Mishnah brought this additional example. But you could understand here that the method for acquisition is different than that of the ratio of the Mishnah. The ratio of the Mishnah, the way that they got acquisition here is ochzin. They're holding on to the talit. That's what gave them the kinyan. That's what gave them the quote-unquote rights to the object. On the other hand, with regards to the behemah, we see either rochev, that they're both riding on the animal, or one's riding on the animal and one's leading the animal. All of those are good forms of kinyan when it comes to an animal. And what the Mishnah is indicating is that they're also equal forms of acquisition. And so even if one is leading an animal and one is riding the animal, that doesn't give precedence to either of the two parties. You could have argued the one riding the animal has a more intimate kinyan with the object, and that should be a stronger form of kinyan than manhig. What the Mishnah says is that the one leading the animal and the one riding the animal are in the same situation or have the same rights here, and therefore yachloku, they will divide it between them. Now, bizman she'im odim, u'she'esh lehem edim, chokim b'lo shvua. The purpose of the shvua is to corroborate their statement, to back up their statement. Sometimes it's also to prevent the people from willy-nilly coming and lying or making a claim. But the shvua, in all those instances, is serving to reinforce the claim or to vet the claim to see if it really is a fair and truthful claim. So in an instance where one of the parties admits, or you have edim backing up one of the parties, then they will no longer need a shvua, because the edim will replace the necessity for a shvua, because edim then are corroborating the claim of that party. And the same is true when it comes to hodah. If there's someone who admits, one of the two litigants admits to some of the claim or some of the statement of the other party, that admission already gives additional corroboration to that statement, and therefore you wouldn't need a shvua to back it up. You can replace the shvua with other means of evidence that probably are even stronger than a shvua, because the shvua is our last resort, because we have no other choice except to basically make you take a shvua, and we assume that you're not going to lie, and we assume that you're fearful of God, and that this is a way to test, like a truth detector. But we use the shvua in the sense that if you take a shvua to Hashem, nobody lies when it comes to God, because God really knows what's happening, and nobody would take the shvua, which can result in a very severe form of punishment, and that's why shvua is used. Now Tosfot over here asks, with regards to the conclusion of the Mishnah by Yachloku, that they split the item, Tosfot wants to know, why is that the case? We have a situation similar to this, where people are fighting over a boat, whether it was an abandoned boat, where it was a boat that the person passed away and has no inheritors, and they're both trying to take possession of the boat. Over there, the Gemara concludes in Baba Batra, called the Olim Gavar. Whoever is stronger wins. They may not be literally or physically whoever is stronger wins. There are other Rishonim say, go Olim Gavar, who has the better proofs, who has the better halachic stand. But over there, we have a different outcome in a situation where parties are fighting over an object, and they're both trying to make a kinyan on over there. And there it says, called the Olim Gavar. Why over here does it say Yachloku? What's the difference? So Tosfot comes up with two qualifications for when the din of our Mishnah is true. There have to be two facts in the case that exist in order for this to be a plausible solution or the right solution to the problem. The first of which is Ochzin, that you have to be in physical contact with the object and be able to take a kinyan through your grasping of the object. And that's what Tosfot's over here. It says, "Veishlamar dochzim shani dechoshev kilu kol echad yeshlo bavadaya chetzi." That when people are holding onto the item, it's as if we are witness to the fact. Anan sade, the ma'aditafi is haididehu. Whatever he's holding onto is his. That's a form of intermittent interaction with the object, and you're grasping the item is a demonstration of ownership over the item, but an intimate demonstration of ownership. You can't do that with a boat. With a boat, you're not going to be lifting the boat up. You're not going to be carrying the boat around. So the ability to have that type of interaction with the object or grab onto the object, that's the first item here that makes it different than other cases. Or if you wanted to bring other cases that are similar to this, it has to be a situation in which they can make a physical kinyan on the object by grasping it, holding onto it. That's number one. The second thing that is important over here is the outcome plausible? That's the second qualification Tosfot has. Is it possible that when we split it between them, that we actually end up with the right answer? So Tosfot brings questions from cases that are coming up on Daf Zayin and other places where there is an argument between the parties. But in that case, it's a binary outcome. Either one guy has the money and the other one doesn't, or vice versa. It can't be that there is some sort of split between them. For instance, the person says, I deposited money with you. And the other guy says, no, you didn't deposit it with me. He's not saying that I paid it off, or we don't say that maybe he paid off half of it. In that case, it's a binary outcome. Either he did lend the money, and he deposited the money, and the guy still has it, or guard, or the person watching it, returned the money to the original owner. So the answer is that one of them owns 100% of the value here. There's no chance that we should split it between them. That will not give you an outcome that is correct. It might be a compromise, which we'll deal with when we get to the Gemara and Sanhedrin, but it's not an outcome that will get you the correct answer to the situation. In our case here, it is plausible that splitting it is the right answer. It might be that one party owns it and the other one doesn't, or vice versa, But it's also possible that they picked it up at the same time, and therefore there is this possibility that splitting it actually gets you to the right answer, which is that they actually both own 50% of this item, or they simultaneously grabbed onto it, and for that reason, splitting it is an answer that could be right. May not be right, but it could be right. So Tosfot says those are the two qualifications to have a case similar to our Mishnah. One is that you have to be able to grab onto it and hold it to demonstrate your ownership. And number two is that it's a outcome that has a plausibility in the circumstances. That it is possible that they should be splitting it over here and that we might end up with the right answer. If again it's a binary outcome where either one party is right 100%, the other one is completely wrong, in that case, it won't fit into our Mishnah because then being cholek is a form of compromise, not a form of psak in the sense of that this could be the rightful and proper outcome to the situation. The other thing that Tosafot, many of the Rishonim discuss over here is the individual who says chetzi shali, when he makes the claim that I agree that the other half is yours, this is my half, why isn't he believed with the migo that he could have made a claim for the whole thing? Instead, he only makes a claim for half of it. So he should be Naaman because he could have made for himself a stronger claim or a bigger claim that actually would have benefited him. Here he took the worst claim and says only half of it is for me, which actually puts him in a worse position in the negotiation. So why isn't that a Migo, or why isn't he believed because of that Migo? So Tosafot over here says, Mefaresh Rivam, de Migo lotzi lo amrina. We don't say a Migo to take property out of another person's hands, b'chetzio sheni mukzeh kmo zeh. Because in this situation, both of them have acquisition rights here, or ownership rights here, from the fact that they're physically holding it. So we're not going to say all of a sudden he's believed with the Migo, and then that knocks the other player out and says, oh, the other guy's possession of this item is not meaningful. You can't say a Migo when you're trying to extract something from someone else's possession, or someone else's rights of ownership. It's one thing to say a person is believed when we're talking about a claim or a monetary claim against each other and say, well, he had a better claim. The fact that he said this, he should be believed. He's telling the truth. Because there you're not trying to remove the property from someone's possession. You're trying to decide whether this person is telling the truth. Over here, if we say that he's telling the truth through his Migo, we're actually going to remove this possession of property from the other party and say, well, he gets the whole 50%. You have no claim against it at all. But that's not true in our case. Others suggest that there is no Migo because of the Shvuah, because the fact that you have to take a Shvuah anyway, and so that doesn't help you, because even if he made a claim for Kulashali, he would still have to take a Shvuah. So therefore, that claim is not any better claim than saying half of it, because in both instances, he's going to end up taking a Shvuah, and so it's not necessarily a better route by which you would say Migo, that you would invoke that principle of Migo over here. And therefore, the Rishonim say that in our Mishnah, just because he said chetzia is not an indication of the fact that he's telling the truth. Now the Gemara says, Lamali mitna zeomer ani mitzatia zeomer ani mitzatia. Why is the Mishnah so verbose and says the fact that this guy says I found it and this guy says I found it? Zeomer kula shali, zeomer kula shali. He says it's all mine, and the other one says it's all mine. Litnei chado. Just write it as one thing. Now that question really has two parts to it, both of which the Gemara will address. Either just write one of the two statements, and I would have known the other one, or just say ani mitzatia, or say ze kula shali. Either way, you would have known the information we need to know in our Mishnah. Or litnei chada means, why don't you combine them? That's the first way that the Gemara is going to read it. Why do you need two separate statements, put them together into a single statement? Gemara says, chadak tani. That's exactly what it means in the Mishnah. Ze omer ani mitzatia ve kula shali. Ze omer ani mitzatia ve kula shali. That's what the Mishnah means. Mishnah, each one of them is saying, I found it and it's 100% mine. The other individual is saying that I found it and it's 100% mine. Gemara says, velitnei ani mitzatia. Just write alone the terminology ani mitzatia. Vane yadana de kula shali. And then I would know that his claim is it all belongs to me. The fact that he says I found it means that I am the rightful owner of this. Implicit in that statement is that I own 100% of it. Why do you have to tell me that explicitly? It would have been inferred or obvious from the first statement. Where it says, itan ani mitzatia, had it just written ani mitzatia, havamina, I would have thought, my mitzatia. What does mitzatia mean? Ri'itia, that I saw it. It is like the way that we use the word today to find. For instance, if you lost something in your house and you're looking all over the place and then you finally find it, When you find it, does that mean that you actually went and grabbed it and picked it up? Finding it would be that you identified where the object is. You'll scream out to the people looking all over the house for a certain thing, and all of a sudden you spot it. You say, I found it. That doesn't mean that you picked it up. It means that you have visual contact with the object. You know where it is now. That doesn't mean you necessarily picked up the item. So that's what the Gemara is saying. Had the Mishnah just said ani mitzatia, you would have thought it meant that he has visual contact with the object, not physical contact with the item. So avagav delata the yadei, even though it never came into his physical possession, b'riya ba'alma koni, it would be sufficient that when he spots it, that he becomes the owner. I mean, the first one to see this lost item becomes the owner of the item. You don't need a physical kinyan in order to acquire the avedah. So that's why, had it not written kula shali, that's what I would have thought the word mitzatia means that. Therefore, tana kushali, therefore it writes to li, debriya lokani, to teach you that it's not through sight that you acquire. It means that you physically picked up the object, that you are in contact with the object, and that's what gives you the right of claim over here. Mar says, umi matzid amarts, my mitzatia riatia. Can you really say that the definition of the word mitzatia, I found it, means that I sighted it, that I saw it? Can you really give that interpretation? Had the Mishnah not had kula shali, could you have said that the word mitzia means that? Ba'amar, rabinai, or ravina, umitzata. We had this just in the Gemara in Baba Kama on Kufyud Gimel. When the pasuk says umitzata, the atiya liyade mashma, that it came into his possession is what it means. There it's speaking about the requirement to return an aveda only applies to achicha, only applies to a Jew, does not apply to a non-Jew because he's not considered to be achicha. We discussed that much more extensively over there in that sugya. But the Gemara says, how do you know that's the truth? Maybe it is that when you see an aveda on the ground, that for a Jew you'd have to pick it up and ensure that it gets back to the rightful owner. Then if it's a non-Jew's object, you could just leave it there on the ground. You don't have to go out of your way to pick it up and find the rightful owner. But on the other hand, if it came into your possession, you actually picked it up, or you took possession of the item, then maybe there's an equal obligation under law to return it to a Jew as it is to return it to a non-Jew. So then the Gemara over there brings this statement of Rabbi Nai or Ravina, which says that umitza'ata. The pasuk says, I found it. Means that it's in your possession already. And there the pasuk qualifies that and says, achicha, only your brother are you obligated to return it to. So even if it comes into your possession, the requirement of a shalat aveda only applies to achicha. But from there you see that the definition of the word mitzata means that you are in physical possession of the item, not that you have a sighting of the item. But it says, you're right, mitzata dekra the atayade mashma. When the Torah uses the word mitziyah, that means having physical possession of the item. Umi utana lishna da'amanakat. For midechazile amar anash kachit. On the other hand, our author of the Mishnah uses the word mitziyah or mitza'ah in its colloquial form, which is what do people mean when they say, I found it. Over there, it could mean, I sighted it, I saw it. Therefore, a person, when he says, I found it, even though he's not in physical possession of it, but just has sighted it, he says, I found it. Even though he never came into his possession, b'ri'ya ba'alma koni. And therefore, b'ri'ya ba'alma, you would have sufficed. And therefore, tani kula shali. The kula shali comes along to tell you that b'ri'ya ba'alma lo koni la. That sighting of the object is not sufficient grounds to be deemed a kinyan. So the first thing the Gemara says is, you have to know that the Mishnah is not the Torah. Meaning that Torah Shebichtav has a certain style and usage of words, and they have a meaning in that context. When you talk about a Mishnah has that same concept on its own, which is that it's a body of work where words are used in a certain way with a certain meaning. And what the Gemara is telling us here is that that's much closer to the street version or the way that people speak rather than the abstract or academic meaning of the word. So in the Torah, mitziyah, that's the true meaning of the word mitziyah as it's used in the Torah. But the word mitziyah that is used in the Mishnah is the way that the Hamun Am uses the word mitziyah, and that would mean even the sighting of the object. And for there, we would have thought to conclude that the sighting of the object is sufficient to grant you a kinyan. That's why Kula Shali comes to dispel that notion and say that you have to actually have physical kinyan. The Gemara says, okay, then why don't we just do it in reverse? Why don't we just write Kula Shali? If I write Kula Shali, then I won't need all of this. That's what Gemara says. Litnei Kula Shali. Lo bane ani mitzatia. Then I don't need the extraneous language of mitzatia. Itani Kula Shali. If you wrote to Kula Shali, have, I mean, I would have thought, ba'alma diktani mitzatia biriya ba'alma kani. I would think that anywhere else in Shas where the Mishnah uses the term mitzatia or mitzia, it means that through visual contact with the object, not through a physical kinyan with the object. So Tana ane mitzatia. Along comes our Mishnah and says ani mitzatia v'adar tana kula shali, and then writes kula shali, the Mishnah yetera, from the extraneous language, the verbosity of the Mishnah, ashmiina, I can then conclude diriya lo kani, that riya doesn't work, not only over here, but in any case. Meaning that our Mishnah would have sufficed to say zeh kula shali. You could have done that, and you would have solved your problem. You would have got what you wanted. You have a claimant making a claim for 100%, and zeh kula shali also gets rid of the problem that you might have thought re'i abama is the kinyan. That's not right. Kula shali means a physical kinyan, a grasp of the item. And so for that reason, kula shali would have sufficed. Why does the Mishnah then go and write ani mitzatia? To make it into a paradigm, definitional Mishnah, to tell you what does the word mitziah mean throughout Shas. That is, that the word mitziah is defined in this Mishnah, and the definition from this Mishnah will then be applied throughout Shas. Mm-hmm. And the definition in this Mishnah is that re'iyah doesn't work. How do I know that? Because of kula shali. But then, how do I know to extrapolate it to other items? They wrote zeomer mitzatiyah, that extraneous language, which is unnecessary, comes to teach you that when you see the word mitziah in the Mishnah, its definition or its meaning is physical contact with the object, physical acquisition of the object. Now the Gemara then goes back and challenges this whole thing after it's gone through this and says, Amim atzid amart, chadoktani. Can you really say that this is one claim over the parties? And there actually is only one case over here. The one case is, zeomer mitzatiyah, veomer kula shali. That it's all part of one big statement of the claimant over here. Gemara says, can you really say that? V'hazeh v'zeh k'toni. In the Mishnah, it starts out each phrase with the word zeh. Zeh omer ani mitzatiyah, v'zeh omer ani mitzatiyah, zeh omer kula shali, v'chulei. Had you wanted it to be a single statement by one party, then it should have been zeh omer ani mitzatiyah, v'kula shali. The fact that you use the opening term v'zeh again seems to indicate that it is a separate statement or a separate case altogether, that the two are not connected. Because if they were connected, then it shouldn't have said zeh on both of them. So now we're back to square one, which is, why do we have the language of zeh omer ani mitzatiyah, zeh omer kula shali? Why is that necessary in the Mishnah? So here Amar Rav Papa, v'itei Rav Shimi bar Ashi, so Rav Papa or Rav Shimi bar Ashi says, v'amri la kadi, and some say that, now the word kadi, Rashi, in different places in Shas, says different things. In some places, Rashi says, Kadi means without attribution. Which means that one version of this was Rav Papa speaking. Another version is Rav Shimi, V'amri La. And then there's some who say that it was said without attribution. Meaning that there was no authorship assigned to the statement. The other possibility of Kadi, Rashi brings in some places, it's the name of an Amora. And therefore it says, V'amri La Kadi. Some say that Kadi was the one who said it. He is the Amora that said it. So Rashi again, some places says that he's an Amora. In other places says it means without attribution anonymously. Now the Gemara says this is what the answer to the question is. Reisha b'mitzia, b'seifa b'mekach u'memkar. Two different cases within the Reisha of the Mishnah. And they both have the same din. When you say zeomer ani mitzatia, zeomer mitzatia, that's a mitzia case. And when it's zeomer kula shali, zeomer kula shali, it's a mekach u'memkar case. That there are actually two cases in this Mishnah, one of which revolves around a mitziah, which is obvious from the Mishnah and what we've discussed until now, which is that two people pick up a mitziah together. And that's what the Reisha case is speaking about. The latter case in the Mishnah is speaking about a case of mekach u'memkar, a transaction between parties. But now you have to find out a way or figure out a way where you can simulate this situation that we have by mitziah. Now again, with regards to mitziah, it's very easy to understand the circumstances. By mekach u'memkar, it's much harder to understand the circumstances. How do two people have a claim on something that they bought? So the answer that the Gemara will say is that they both purchased it from a single seller. The seller sold it to two people, And now they're coming along and they're saying, I bought it. And the other one says, I bought it. What do we do in that situation? Again, we're going to discuss that in more in depth in 1 second. Now, Rashi over here, he says that in a case where each one of them makes a claim that is mutually exclusive, for instance, one says that I wove the garment, the other one says no, that I wove the garment, then over there Rashi says there's no reason to split it between them because one of them is definitely Ramai, is a thief. And therefore it should be left around until Eliyahu comes and tells us who is the proper owner over here. Although Tosafot on the next Amud says that case would definitely be a case where we would definitely split it ayidei shvuah, because the shvuah will compel the individual to tell the truth, and we'll get to the bottom of the situation. V'tzricha, and you need to tell me the din is true both by a metziah and a veda, as well as by mekach u'memkare transaction. Deitan a metziah, because had you just wrote the case of finding an object, hava mina metziah the ramu rabbanan shvuale. In the case of a metziah, the rabbanan forced him to take a shvuah, so that he doesn't take action or do something that is theft that he can justify, which is mishum demori va'amar, because this individual could justify it to himself, convince himself of the fact, hakavrai lav midei chaser ba, he's not going to lose anything if I take a portion of this aveda, izil itvis, I'll go and grab it, v'itlig v'hadei, and I will split it with him. Or in other words, the mentality of this individual is, the fact that this person found something, he hit the jackpot, he won the lottery ticket, it wasn't something that he was planning for, wasn't something that if he didn't get, he would have lost out, it's all profit to him. It's all benefit to him because there was no expenditure over here, he simply found the item. So what the other individual does is, he's mora heter, that he convinces himself or justifies himself that, I could take the other half, because even if I take half, this guy's still better than he was without it. He found this item, so he gets 50% of it instead of 100% of it, but he still hit the jackpot, he still got the lottery ticket, just won't be as big a payout as it was before. So therefore, Chazal wanted to stop that mentality and say, take a shvuah, so that we know that you're telling the truth over here. Aval mekach chomemkar, delek lameimar achi, by a transaction where you wouldn't say such a thing, aim alone. Over there, maybe you wouldn't require a shvuah, because over there's no reason to be mora heter to the fact that this person bought it, and I bought it, and therefore I should keep it, or I should make the claim like that to keep it, because what's the justification for that? Over there, you're losing money. In Mekach HaMemkar, the person is losing out. Now, it's not exactly losing out over here, because they're purchasing an object. And if one of them prevails in the case, his money will stay with the seller, and he'll get the object. The other party, we refunded his money because he didn't get the object. So it's not necessarily a real loss in terms of that loss of money or monetary loss. Elaim Cain, he can't get his money back from the mocher, from the seller. But the more likely way to explain this is, over here, the loss might be the fact that he transacted to buy something. Which is that he came and bought something, and he wants to keep it. Now, if you go and take it away from him, and you buy it instead of him, if it's not available anymore, then you really have caused him the loss in the sense that he can't acquire this object. Or even if it is available, now you're forcing him to now expend energy to go out and buy it and find it again and transact again. So in either case, there is that loss, not in the typical sense of a loss, but it's going to cost him time, money, lost opportunity, and therefore we deem that to be a loss. And maybe over there, we wouldn't worry about him telling the truth, and the chachamim would not compel him to take a shvuah. Vitana mekach u'memkar. If the Mishnah just wrote about a transactional case, not an aveda case, then I would have thought mekach u'memkar who the ramu rabbanan shvuah. There, the rabbanan forced him to take a shvuah in a transactional situation. Mishum de mori v'amar. Again, he convinces himself, justifies himself. Chavrai demei kayoyiv. My friend gave money to the seller. Vana demei kayoyivna. And I also gave money to the seller. Hashta de tzricha l'didi. Since I need this object, I need what he has. Ashkale ano, I'll take it. V'chavrai lizel litrach lisbon. Let him go out and buy it for himself. Replace it by buying it somewhere else. So here, one can justify to themselves that the lie here is not really a lie because the other guy will get his money back. The other guy can go buy it somewhere else. In that, I'm not really causing him so much of a problem. Aval mitziah, telekala meimarachi. By mitziah, where you can't say that, emalo. So in that case, maybe you would not be required to take a shvuah. Tzricha, therefore we need both cases over here. So what it's saying is, in the case of Metziah, he recognizes that this is a unique object. You're not going to find another Metziah out there. And therefore, he doesn't go and steal it from his friend or grab the other half and say, I want half of it, because he knows it's an irreplaceable object, because not everywhere you're going to find a metziah. It's not going to replicate itself somewhere else. On the other hand, when you're dealing with mekkel memkar, where you're dealing with a transaction for an object, maybe even a commodity, then in that case, it's fungible, replaceable. If I take this one, the guy will find himself another one. So then he might have talked himself into saying that he was right for doing this. Therefore, the Chachamim forced a shvuah on him. But in the case of metziah, where he doesn't have that logic, maybe he would not impose a shvuah on him. Now, it's true that the two parts of this, srichuta, are almost mutually exclusive, which is that the reasoning that you would believe mekkel chamemkar requires a shvuah and not metziah, or the other way around, metziah requires a not mekkel chamemkar, are for opposing reasons or opposite reasons. So here the Gemara, as a continuum, is difficult because it doesn't flow. The logic that you dictate on one side is then exactly the reverse logic in the next situation. So either you have to say that these were discrete discussions that are put together here in order to deal with one topic, or you have to say that the Gemara does this in a number of places, which is it acknowledges a certain logic, and then it'll go on and do it just the opposite and show just the opposite. Not that they have to reconcile, not that they are singular in their logic, but rather it's just a way to test all sides of the situation or to speak to every side of the situation. Which is, if it was like this, I would say this. If it was like this, I would say that. And even though they're opposites, they still produce the same outcome, which is you can't just write one type or form. You can't just write a Veda, or you can't just write Mekkel Chamemkar. You need both of them. Okay, now the Gemara asks your question. Mekkel Chamemkar. When it comes to this case of a transaction, lech se zuzei miman nokat. Why don't you just ask the seller from whom he received the money? And then he can tell us who was the buyer in this case. Lotzricha denakat mitarvayu. He took money from both of them. Well, then if he took money from both of them, he is a thief. He sold an item twice. The Gemara says, it's a case, michad midate, michad baal korche. He sold the item to one party willingly. He sold it to the other party under duress. He was compelled to sell it to the other party. V'lo yadana, mihu midate, umihu baal korche. He doesn't remember which one of the parties gave him the money voluntarily and purchased it from him voluntarily, and which one compelled him to sell the object. Now he has the money from both parties, but he's not certain as to which of the parties gave him the money in this situation. Rashi over here says that when it says velo yadana in the Gemara, which Rashi says the proper garsina over here is lo yadinan, that we do not know which party it went to, because even if the mocher knew which party it belonged to, that would not be a reason to determine in the case. The Gemara in other places tells us that the mocher is neman, the seller is neman to tell us who the buyer is, as long as the object is still in his possession. As long as he still has the object, he remembers who bought it. He is midakdek on getting it to the person who bought it. Once the item has left his possession, he basically wipes his hands of it and doesn't follow it, doesn't think about it anymore, and he loses his nemanut to determine who was the buyer in this situation. Therefore, Rashi says the proper girsa in the Gemara should be below yadinan. We don't know which party did it willingly or voluntarily, and which party did it against the will of the balim and forced his hand. Because you can't say velo yada, that the mocher doesn't know, because if you say the mocher doesn't know, that implies if he did know, he could sway the case. And Rashi says that's not true. Even if the mocher knew the information, once they left him, once the object left him, he's no longer believed to tell us who is the party here, and therefore he's no different than any other person in the world. And for that reason, Rashi says that the girsa here should be velo yadinan. We don't know the information, because had we known the information, then we could adjudicate the case properly, but we don't have the information, and therefore we're left in a bind here. We have two claimants coming for the same object that was sold to them. That's the way Rashi learns. Tosafot rejects Rashi's explanation and says the lo yodo over here could even be the mocher. And he says that the mocher is neman in this situation. Even though generally once the object leaves the mocher's possession, he's not believed. But Tosafot says is, you're right, he's not believed as the mocher. He doesn't have that added nemanut, that added believability because he is the mocher in this case, but he should be no worse than any third party that comes in and makes a statement about the information. If you're in a deadlock between two parties, and now we would impose a shvua on both parties, if an Ed Echad comes in and supports one of the parties, that party will not need to take a shvua anymore. Only the opposing party would have to take a shvua, and you have to actually take a shvua d'oraita now, not just a shvua d'rabbanan, as we'll see that this shvua is. So he should be no worse than an Ed Echad. The mocher should be no worse than an Ed Echad, and should be able to compel one party to take a shvua and exempt the other party. So Tosfot says, if the mocher knew, it would make a difference in the case. And therefore, it's fine to be goreis in the Gemara of here, v'lo yoda. The mocher doesn't remember, doesn't know the information. Had he known the information, he actually would have swayed the case. Not because he's the mocher, just simply because he's an Eid Echad. And therefore, Tosfot favors the girsa that says v'lo yoda, versus Rashi, who says the girsa should be v'lo yadina, that we don't know, versus Tosfot says, even if you write it as he doesn't know, that's good, because if he did know, he would make an impact on the case. And now the Gemara continues and says, Lema matnitin deloka ben nanas. Let us say that our Mishnah is not like ben nanas. Di ben nanas. Ben nanas says in the Gemara in Shvot, Hamar, Ketzad, how is that possible? Elu b'elu b'in lidei shvuat shav. They're both going to end up in a situation where they're taking a false shvua. The scenario of the case is, an individual has polim, workers that work for him. Instead of paying the man in cash at the end of the day, he says to them, go to the makolet, pick out whatever you want, and then I'll pay for the bill in the end. And he goes to the chedmani and he says, give them credit, and I'll take care of the bill. So then the balabite leaves the situation there. The workers come back to him and say they didn't receive anything. They didn't get money from him, obviously, but they also didn't get anything, food or items from the makolet. The bala makolet comes along and says, these guys took this food from me, and you owe me the money for it. So the Mishnah, the Chachamim say in the Mishnah there, both of them are nishba v'notel. The polim take a shvua that they were never paid, and then he has to pay them. The balachanu takes a shvua that he never got paid for the merchandise that he laid out, and he gets paid by the balabait. The balabait is actually out now, twice over. He's going to have to pay his workers, and he's going to have to pay the balachanut. Rabbi Shimon ben Anas over there says, that is a terrible solution to the problem, because you're guaranteeing a shvuat shav. We know for sure that one of them is lying because their positions are mutually exclusive. It can't be that the polim got nothing and that the balabait owes the chenvani money for the credit extended. And it can't be that he owes the money to the chenvani, because then for sure the polim were paid. And what the polim are saying is incorrect, because they're denying the fact that they were paid. So therefore the positions are mutually exclusive. And by taking a shvua here, you're guaranteeing at least one of them is taking a shvuat shav. One of them is lying. Afilu teima ben Anas. Even ben Anas can be the author of the Mishnah. Hotam vadaika shvuat shav. Over there, there's a certainty of a shvuat shav. The positions are so mutually exclusive that there's no way that they both could be telling the truth. If the Poalim are telling the truth, he owes no money to the Chenvani. The Chenvani is telling the truth, he doesn't owe any money to the Poalim. Hokaika lemeimar deleka shvuat shav. Over here, it's possible to say that it is not a shvuat shav. Imor de tarvayu ba'dei adodi agbua. They both picked it up at the same moment, or they picked it up simultaneously. Meaning here, there is a possible manifestation of that being true, and therefore it's not a guarantee of a shvuat shav. In the case of the Poalim and the Chenvani and the Balabait, there's a certainty of a shvuat shav being the outcome. And Rashi says maybe the same thing would be true by Klinian Mekach, Umemkar, Nami, Shemelish, Nehem, Mitratzeh. Maybe he really did sell the item to both of the parties over here. And so there is a possible case where it would not be a shvuat shav, and they're both telling the truth. So therefore, in our case, there is a plausible outcome that will not result in a shvuat shav. For that reason, maybe Ben Anas agrees that you would take a shvua in our case, even though he does not allow you to take a shvua in the case in Shvuot. Let us say that this Mishnah is not like Sumchus. This Kusumchus, Sumchus we bumped into a number of times in Baba Kama, Tamar Mamonu Mutabas Afek, Chokim, Elo Shvua. Any money that is in a position of doubt, we don't know who the rightful owner of the property is, you should split it without having to take a Shvua, which would be against our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that Chokim, Bishvua, they do require Shvua. Sumchus does not require a Shvua. So Elamai, so what are you going to suggest? Rabbanon, the Rabbanon are the authors of our Mishnah? Their principle is whoever wants to extract the item, whoever wants to move it from its current state or position, they have the burden of proof. So the Chachamim don't just say, oh, take a shvua and we split it. No, the Chachamim say, And therefore, you'd have to bring proof or evidence of the fact that you are the true owner of the item. It says, hi, mine. You can't compare the Rabbanan Shita to Sumchus. Eliyah, my Bishlama Rabbanan. If you say the authors of our Mishnah are the Rabbanan, Hotam de lo tafse darvayu amru Rabbanan mozi chaveru lavaraya. In the case in Baba Kama, there the Chachamim say, since they aren't in possession of it, they're not holding the item, then the governing principle is, whoever wants to take the, or move the object from where its current state is, he's got to bring a proof, or he has the burden of proof. Hacha tarvayu tafse. Here, both of them are holding on to the talit. Pagi la b'shvua. Therefore, you divide it by a shvua. According to the Chachamim, the application of motzi mechaveru alav araya is only in a case where one of the parties is mukzak in the item. One of the parties is the owner of the item, and the other party is trying to remove that property from them. In that case, the Chachamim say, motzi mechaveru alav araya. In our case over here, they're both holding it. There's evidence that they both are owners over here, or they are both the mukzak in the item. So that won't be a determining factor anymore to use the principle of a motzi mechaveru alav araya, because it's not relevant in this case. And therefore, you would use the mechanism of the Mishnah, which says, yachloku b'shvua. Eliyah amar tzumchus. But if you say that the author of the Mishnah is sumchus, hashtom ha'otam over there, in the case of Baba Kama, delo tafsi tarvayu, they're not in physical possession of the object. Chokim below shvua. He says still over there, they take, divide it up without a shvua. Over here where they're both holding on to it, certainly he would not require a shvua, because both of them have exerted rights over here, or demonstrating rights to this object. Over there, in the case, he doesn't require a shvua, even though they're not in physical contact, they don't have a kinyan on the object, yet he still says split it, no shvua. Over here where there is good reason to believe that they both have possession over here, why wouldn't he say split it without a shvua? It's a koshkein. It's obvious that over here, where they are in physical contact with the object, that they should split it. It says, no, afilu teima sumchus. Even sumchus could be the author of our Mishnah. Ki amar sumchus, when did sumchus say that we split it? That's shema v'shema. When you have a case where neither party can make a definitive claim. They are both uncertain as to what really happened, the facts of what happened. They both make a claim on their own behalf, because each one of them will be a beneficiary of the way that you word it. But it's still a shema and a shema. Valbari ubari lo amar. But if they both make definitive claims, over there, sumchus didn't say that. Our Mishnah is a case of bari ubari. Each one of them is saying zekula shali, zekula shali. That's a definitive claim. There's no uncertainty over here. They know what the facts were. And therefore, there you would not be exempt from a shvua. It's only a case of shema and shema that sumchus says you split it without a shvua, because what type of shvua are they going to take? They say they don't know or they don't remember. So how can then you force them to take a shvua when there is a shema claim? They might not have been there. They may not have cited it. And so how would they have any information to take a shvua to corroborate their claim? Their claim is just to benefit them, but their claim is not definitive in a way they can take a shvua to back it up. Gemara says, Ularaba bar Ravuna damar amar sumchos afilu bari ubari. Michael Maymar, what are you going to say there? What about Rabbi Ravuna says that Sumchus's din applies even when you have definitive claims on both sides? That can't be the answer here. Because he says, even in that case, Chokim below Shvua. That's a case he can't fit into our Mishnah. Afilu Teima Sumchus. Even according to Rabbi Ravuna, you can say that it's Sumchus. Kiyama Sumchus Echa Deika Droru De Mamona. But Echa Deika Mamona, lo. Sumchus only says you split it when there is a Droru De Mamona. Rashi claims Droru De Mamona is Hefseid, where there's going to be a monetary loss, chisaron mamon. Because if you pay this guy shlokadin, it's a loss of money for the other party. If you let them go without this din, then it's a loss to the other party. Meaning that in this case where there's going to be a loss to both parties, there we say split it. But in a situation where there is no chisaron mamon, there's no loss of money, over there, we would require a shvua, or we would not apply the principle of chokim that we split it. That's the way Rashi learns. The Balei Tosafot, the Ramban, and others criticize Rashi's explanation over here. Happens to work well in our case, because it's a case of aveda where there is no chisaron mamon, and therefore, you would understand why Sumchus might have a different din over here by aveda that he has by a transactional or a case of fighting over ownership of a particular object. Tosfot says there are other places in Shas where the Gemara uses the term Droru de Mamona, and saying Chisaron Mamon is not a valuable explanation in those situations. Therefore, the Baal Yetosafot believed that Gerardo de Mamona means that the Safek exists without the claimants. There is a Safek independent of the claimants. Even if the claimants didn't show up in Beit Din, we'd still have a Safek. The situation or the case in Baba Kama is a case where one guy's selling a para and the other guy's buying the para. They did it through a barter transaction. He gave him a donkey. So the guy made a kinyan on the donkey. Automatically, his kinyan on the donkey gives the counterparty a kinyan in the cow. But we go see the cow, and all of a sudden we see a little calf next to the cow. Was the calf born before the transaction took effect? Before they made a kinyan on the chamor? Or was the calf born after the transaction went through, and therefore it belongs to the buyer and not to the seller? That's a fake exists, irrespective of the claimants over here. It's a question. We don't know when that calf was born. So we don't know whether it was before or after the transaction. And the safek exists independent of their claims. On the other hand, in our case here with the Aveda, there's no safek in the Aveda until the claimants come along and one says it's mine, the other one says it's mine. Otherwise, the Aveda is hefker, it's out there, it's ownerless. So the safek only comes into being, is only created by their claims. And therefore, Tosafot says that's the difference. Sumchus says when there is a safek or pre-existing safek, over there he would say it's chokim below shvua. But in a case where the whole safek is generated by the fact that they are making a claim, over there we would not say chokim below shvua. And the Gemara says, balav kavachomer hu? Isn't it a kavachomer? Ma'atam de'ika drar de mamona lemar. Ika drar de mamona lemar. Over there in Baba Kama, when it talks about this case of the cow giving birth, where according to Rashi, the loss of money for this party, a loss of money for that party. Veika lemeimer kulu lemar, veika lemeimer kulu lemar. And over there, the calf either belongs to this party or that party. I mean, it totally belongs to one of the two parties. Amar Sumchos mamona mutabu safek chokim. He says that if it's a safek, we split it without a shvua, below shvua. Hacha, the leka drarud mamona. In our case over here, where there is no drarud mamona, there's no hefsed mamon. There is, according to Tosfot, no pre-existing safek. Tika lemeimer tarvayui. That it's plausible that it actually belongs to both parties. Lokoshikain, certainly you shouldn't have to take a shvua over here. Over here, there's more reason to split the object without a shvua. Over there, one of the two parties' claim is a lie. One of the two parties is not telling the truth. Over here, where there is a possibility what they're saying is true, that they both are owners of this object, and that there's not only one object, one owner. It's not a binary situation. The case in Baba Kama is a binary situation. Over here, it's a situation in which it's not only could be owned by one and not the other, but it could be owned by both of them jointly. And so there, certainly you would split it even without a shvua, because there's more reason to believe that they're telling the truth over here than there was in the case of the para. Gemara says, afilu tema sumchus. Still, sumchus could be the author of our Mishnah. Shvua zumi derabanani ki derabi Yochanan. The shvua in our Mishnah is a takanat chachamim, not a shvua deoraita, but rather a shvua derabanan that was imposed here. And as the Gemara says, "Damar Rabbi Yochanan shvua zu takanat chachamimi shlo yehi kol echad v'echad olech v'tokev v'talito shechaveiro v'omer shelihu." It was a preventative mechanism. It was an institution to prevent people from just seeing someone picking up an aveda and then going on and grabbing the other half of it or grabbing it away from him, because that will not suffice to determine that he is the owner. Therefore, we impose a shvua on him in order to force him to deal with his claim and not just say, oh, yeah, half of it is mine, I grabbed half of it, or he goes after the fact, grabs half of it. He has to know that that's also going to result in him taking a shvua, and that shvua is a preventative measure to stop people from trying to exert ownership where they really don't have ownership, or quote-unquote stealing from people when they find an aveda. If they know that the outcome will result in a shvua, they're less likely to engage in such behavior or such activity, and that is the Esfar de Rabbanan that Rabbi Yochanan says we're speaking about here. And therefore, Sumchus, who says Chokim below Shvua, might agree here that there's a Shvua. Not Me'ikar Adin that there's a Shvua, but there's a Shvua de Rabbanan over here the Mishnah is speaking about that helps us to adjudicate or figure out the case in this situation. Okay, we're going to stop here, 8 lines down on the top of Gimel Amud Aleph.